Good morning, everybody. Thanks very much for being so patient and to apologize about the slight delay. I thank you very much for being here today to discuss with us, hear from us about, and the speakers about a very, very important topic today, which is Lebanese politics, Lebanese confessionalism. First, a little bit of housekeeping things. Please, if there is any possibility to turn off your cell phones, it'll be nice. Better, more conducive to talking freely without interruptions. Also, I'd like you to please pay attention to some USIP materials outside, some biographical information about our speakers. Please avail yourselves of them. And also, I'd like to remind you that this is a public event, and it's on the record, obviously, and it is being recorded in audio. So, first, I thought I'd introduce the topic a little bit. The political science in me tells me, well, you should really talk about it before somebody else starts talking about it. Explain it a little bit. So, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be basically talking about what is confessionalism for just a couple of minutes. In political science terminology, confessionalism is a system of government that proportionally allocates political power between a country's communities, whether religious or ethnic, according to their numbers in the population. It derives its nature from another more academic term that's called consociationalism. It's a big word that really is built upon four major principles. First one is the allocation of such of political posts among different communities, whether religious or ethnic. Second is a grand coalition between the leaders of such communities. They all get together to basically hammer out issues of great importance for the country. The third one is basically the autonomy of each community in its own personal status affairs, in its own internal affairs, without necessarily having the state as a collection of laws and institutions interfere in those personal status affairs. And the fourth one, and this is the big problem as far as I'm concerned, is the mutual veto power that such a consociational formula has within it. The future, mutual veto power of communities basically vetoing decisions that they might deem to be detrimental to their communal interests. At the time of independence from France in 1943, the National Pact, which is basically a gentleman's agreement between then-President Bashar al-Khoury, who was a Maronite Christian, and his prime minister, who was a Riyad Sulh, who was a Sunni Muslim, this formula consecrated the allocation of powers among religious communities. And they basically decided that, well, the presidency would be a Maronite Christian presidency, and the prime ministership would go to the Sunnis, and the speakership of parliament would go to the Shia. Other lower posts, like Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Deputy Speaker of Parliament, all these things were also divided along sectarian lines as well, so that everybody would get a little piece of the pie, so to speak. But at the same time, mind you, everybody has the same mutual veto power that they all have on political decisions that really pertain to really big events, big affairs of the country. While the formula was really good for maintaining civic peace and for a gradual democratic development, it simply could not ameliorate other problems. Having all kinds of religious communities meant an eventual extension of regional politics into domestic affairs. While the Muslims in general wanted close relations with the Arabs, with their brother Arabs, the Christians, while not denying that they are Arabs, also wanted to maintain close relations with the West as a counterbalance to the Muslim majority around them. In a sense, confessional politics and the regional influences worked toward making the country an open and tolerant society while allowing its communities to have mutual veto powers on what it could do and stand for. Today's troubles, problem of coalition government, stem from the interaction between this formula and the regional dynamics. While the country has to maintain its civic peace and democracy, regional considerations are drawing it into basically unwanted territory. Today's panelists will try to shed some light on this, on Lebanon and its confessional formula. Hassan Naimni will discuss the development of the Lebanese system and assess its chances for change and evolution. Marwan Khredi will discuss the role of the media in Lebanon's confessional politics, while Hisham Milham will discuss confessionalism as both a formula for good governance but a cautionary equation for the region. Hassan?
I'd like to start actually by mentioning issues of nomenclature. As Imad was saying, I mean, the word that he used was confessionalism, and then he tried to place it in the wider context of consociationalism and defining the terms that in political theory at least are assigned, the aspects that are assigned to such representation. Actually, other names, other terms were also used, such as communalism or communitarianism, and all of them lack in terms of describing the Lebanese situation in particular, the Middle Eastern situation in general. And this is actually not unlike the attempt at trying to equate iqta'iyya in the Middle East with feudalism in the West. This is an academic debate, but nonetheless, it's an important one because we often try to project notions that are derived from European history or the European experience into the Middle Eastern context and, in this particular case, into the Lebanese context. I'm going to stick to the term ta'ifiyya, which is the Arabic word, as awkward as it is for you, but nonetheless, I think it's important in order to distinguish it from the others and in order to underline one thing. Actually, I'm going to make three propositions in here in the short time allocated for me. The first one is that ta'ifiyya as a system is not an accident of history. It is not the national pact that creates ta'ifiyya in Lebanon. It is actually not even a product of colonialism. We're not talking here about the impact of the West leading to ta'ifiyya emerging or this system of governance. Actually, the ta'ifiyya as it is today, I would propose, is the current manifestation of an ancestral, proven indigenous system of governance that has dominated the history of the region. I don't want to take you back to Sasanian and Byzantine times, but I assure you, as early as Sasanian times, this communal arrangement, communitarian arrangement, was in place, and actually the Byzantine formula, which was a unitarian one, tried to undo it and failed, and then Islam comes along and readopts it. And throughout the history, basically over the past 1,500 years, what we have is a confirmation of it. However, this system, up until the 20th century, was characterized by certain elements that in the 20th century changed. And I'll very quickly, I promise you, describe what these are and why they changed and how they changed. The first characteristic is a limited conception of state role. The function of the state was one of security. It was not one of services. The second characteristic, which is equally important, is the allocation of many legislative functions to extra-state institutions. Throughout Islamic history and well into Ottoman history, many functions that today we think of as being the domain of the state were not conceived in the Middle East as being as such, including legislation. Most of legislation. This is why, if you'd like, the tension today within political Islamism, whether to integrate legislation into the state or not. In any case, the third characteristic is the reliance on one moral community, one. By moral community here, I mean one conceived community as the defining titular of the state, and therefore there is no need for veto power for the others, because one community dominates. And in this particular meaning, throughout recent history, in the past 500 years, meaning of Ottoman histories, well into the 20th century, this dominant moral community used to be the Sunni community, the Muslim community. With the 19th century, we have a new reality that takes place. We have a confrontation between two models. The model that is the Ta'ifi model that I'm describing, which under the Ottomans were described as being the millati system, and in which Christians of various denominations and Jews had autonomy, internal autonomy, but the Muslim community, the Sunni community in particular, was the dominant one, was one that decides what happens to the state. What happens in the 19th century is that we have a trajectory, an evolution of this system into one that recognizes that the other communities have a political stake in the state. And this is as a result of the confrontation with basically the integration of the Middle East into the world system. Now we have now two competing models. One is that is community-based, and the other that is nation-based, or nation, or for that matter, as it evolves in the West, individual-based. So, but what is important to note in here is that in the, Lebanon might be the only case in which this trajectory of reform of the old system into one in which all communities are on an equal footing. It's the only place in the Middle East where this happens. Another place in the Middle East is also heir to the old system. It's Israel, with now, instead of the Sunni community having the dominant role, it is the Jewish community that does. But in both cases, Lebanon and Israel can claim to have inherited the Ottoman system, which itself is basically an inheritance that goes back literally millennia, while at the same time trying to cope with the new model, with the new model of governance and the new model of state. So the argument, the second proposition that I would make, after saying that therefore Taifiyah is not a novelty, and therefore we can understand why in a recent poll, for example, in Lebanon, 50% of those polled declared that they feel that they were part of their community first and then part of the state. 25% declared that they feel that are both, and only 25% declared that they feel that they're Lebanese first and then part of their community. This arrangement is not the result of a delusion. It's the result of a proven history. The institution that has served the society well throughout history has been the community, not the state. And what we have now is the two models competing. The second proposition, therefore, that I would make is that the ongoing crisis in the Lebanese political system is a result of dissonance between the two models of governance and the two paradigms of state. The two models of governance, one that is community-based, the other that is nation or individual-based, and the bipolarity of the second model is very interesting in itself. This dissonance results in systemic defects that are exploited by special interests. The argument here is that what we have since the 19th century, well into the 20th century, and definitely in the last part of the 20th century and today, what we have is more and more horizontal integration among the various communities into the creation of that common Lebanese space, if you'd like, national space. But you have special interests in the form, namely in the form of communitarian leadership that basically have the advantage, meaning they have the interest of not allowing it to happen because it undermines their authority, their power. So these systemic defects allow the communitarian leadership, but it also allows, as Ahmad was pointing out, it allows regional and international powers to enter the fray and basically contribute to this dissonance, contribute to increasing, to limiting the horizontal integration that I was pointing to. Notably, in the past 25 years or so, Israel and Syria, in addition to the Palestinian presence, so three factors, three regional factors, have intensely contributed to basically abstracting or intercepting or interdicting even the horizontal integration that took place. For example, just to note an example of the way Syria managed Lebanon over the past, all of its presence and occupation, was to deal and communicate and transact with communitarian leaders, with Taifi leaders, but any formation or the emergence of any group that tries to transcend the communitarian order was rejected and fought and ultimately put down by the Syrian overlords of Lebanon and also by the communitarian leaders in Lebanon itself. So this alliance of interest between Syria and the communitarian leaderships was actually blocked a reality. And that reality, especially since the end of the war, on the ground, we witness, and that really the evidence for it is both idiosyncratic and a result of study, we witness a large level of integration that is not reflected in the political process. And this is actually the third proposition that I would make, and this is the point that is really can lead to some hopeful optimism, meaning looking towards the future, that the transition towards the individual state paradigm away from the communal paradigm is taking place whether we try to induce it, promote it or not. It is taking place. It is actually the fact that this paradigm has been adopted in the Middle East, in Lebanon and elsewhere is not up to any political leader. It is happening. The only action that is really required here is that reducing the pains of birth. What we have witnessed so far over the past 50 years is motion towards disintegration and then lapses in the form of civil disorder and clashes that cannot be described as civil war. It's an uncivil war. Nonetheless, these lapses did not end up undoing Lebanon. Lebanon was supposed to be the precarious republic and supposed to be the weakest link in the Middle East, and despite 16 years of devastating wars, did not unravel and actually is still there. I mean, we can still complain about the precariousness of its political system, and we can still complain about the intensity of communitarian feelings, but the fact of the matter, Lebanon is still there, and this is in itself is hopeful. Now, the what can be done, what steps can be done towards confirming this reality, towards helping it, and towards forbidding or at least resisting the attempts by the vertical leaderships, the communitarian leadership, to not allow horizontal linkages. I think that in some cases, the Ta'if Agreement, which was supposed to be Lebanon's second republic, lays the foundation for that in a rather satisfactory way, but the implementation comes lacking. One way of doing it is recognizing the nature of Lebanon as a parliamentary democracy. It is not a popular democracy. It's not a presidential democracy. It's a parliamentary one. And therefore, the point is, in municipal elections in Lebanon, which, by the way, happen in along non-communitarian, meaning it's not along the Ta'ifi lines. By that, I mean that there are no allocation of seats for the various communities at the municipal level. Nonetheless, at the municipal level, people have voted their interest, not their passion, not their community, and therefore configuration of municipal seats, meaning that it's pretty much so reflective of Lebanese society, both in composition but more so in interest. So the idea here is move that success or that formula from the municipal level to the parliamentary level. But in order to do that, one has to take into account the fact that there are still communitarian sensitivities, and these can only be addressed in the form of a bicameral legislature. If Lebanon, not unlike what actually Ta'if had suggested, if Lebanon had a higher chamber and a lower chamber, the lower chamber has the effective legislation power and the higher chamber has the veto power, the higher chamber can remain and probably should remain for the time being communitarian in distribution. It would be like a Senate. In this Senate in here, California and Wyoming in the states are represented both by two senators, despite the fact that California has more than 50 million, while Wyoming does not even have 500,000. So the Senate in Lebanon can end up reflecting the psychological demography of Lebanon, one in which all communities are represented, not necessarily according in proportionality to their numbers, but nonetheless, it would be a safeguard against, if you like, the tyranny of the majority, despite the fact that we do not have a majority in Lebanon of any one group. In any case, that division would move into the parliament the experience that Lebanon has succeeded in working at the level of the parliamentary, at the level of the municipality, and therefore can help transition, create that common space, that extra community. It is often stated that Lebanon has 18 recognized communities. minorities. Actually, it's more like six, with the others really being just tiny minorities. But we need a seventh or a 19th community, which should be a community of civil, of a civil community, one that is not linked to any one sectarian order. And that can be done through the creation of that national space through a parliament that is not communitarian in composition. The other reality that one has to recognize is, and one has to be very careful in dealing with it, and it is also a reflection of the fact that the new model is evolving, is the emergence of a civil society movement in Lebanon that is very much so integrated. While political activity was denied for the past 25 years, a political activity that is not limited to one community was denied over the past 25 years. Civil society organizations did not suffer that restriction, and therefore they have emerged with a high level of integration, and in more ways than one, they are really an indication of what is to come at the political level if the room is allowed for it and if the interdiction on the part of the communitarian leadership does not come in. So basically what needs to happen in Lebanon is, I would argue, towards the confirmation of the new model, is just enhancing the current positive elements rather than trying to revamp the system from the bottom up. There are many issues that are involved with it with regard to the composition of Lebanon that can be addressed. The Lebanese, the Christians in Lebanon today might be, in absolute numbers, if we put all communities together, a minority, but that is if only we count the residents of Lebanon. If we take into account the Lebanese immigrants overseas, the Christians are a majority. So one way to balance the resident majority of Muslims might be to have more of a role for the immigrant majority of Christians. And Lebanon, therefore, is not at a point where its demographic order is problematic. It can lead to, meaning that the prospects for Lebanon, in short, are rather good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hassan, for laying the ground for some of the things I was going to say. What I'd like to do is make three general points and then move on to specifics. The first point I'd like to make is that confessional identities in Lebanon are not primeval. In other words, you hear it very often saying, it's always been like this, it's not going to change. And in fact, the historical record, some of the things that Hassan mentioned, but also there are some new in the last 5 or 6 years, new histories about 19th century Lebanon that argue convincingly, in my opinion, that a lot of the kind of the sectarian structure that we see today is explained by reactions of the communities to Ottoman reforms, the famous Tanzimat, and then to great power competition over influence in the Levant. So that, for instance, and there's ample evidence that, yes, communitarian feelings or identities were in existence in the 18th and 19th century. But if you look at the mountain, for instance, with Druze and Maronites, you see that class factors were at least as strong of an identifier. In other words, you know, in the Iqta'i society, the best translation is feudal, although, as Hassan pointed out, it's not very correct. People felt that they were either, you know, commoners or the feudal lords, more than I'm part of this confession or not. So that's point number one. Point number two, a very interesting phenomenon happened during the war, that a lot of the communities, a lot of the, well, according to some research that's quite convincing, again, and the person I have in mind here is the German social scientist, Theodor Hanf, who argued that basically all the communities developed allegiances to the idea of Lebanon. In other words, before the war, there were multiple allegiances. Some of the communities wanted a kind of a subnational entity. That was very typical of some of the Maronite political discourse. Some others wanted, you know, the pan-Syrian, pan-Arab, or also pan-Islamic territorial ambitions. That, according to Hanf and a couple of others, disappeared during the war, and I tend to agree with that. Finally, the third major point is that the argument that whenever we see initiatives about interconfessional dialogue in Lebanon, that in fact, what many people argue, that the actors themselves don't really intend to negotiate and to change anything, they're just putting up a show. I think this is a false distinction. The fact that political actors make public claims is as important as whatever it is that their real intentions are. So going from that, let me give you a brief historical narrative of the role of the media in the confessional structure of Lebanon, and then trying at the end to kind of see how the three factors that I just mentioned affect and are affected by the media. In pre-war Lebanon, and I'm talking really 50s and 70s, and I'm focusing on television today, the press is somewhat of a different story, and in many ways, with all due respect, less important for this, I think, than television is. But in the pre-war years, there was one television station with two channels, Télé-Liban. Télé-Liban was not really a public station, was not really a state station. It was a hybrid. It was 49% owned by the private sector, 51% owned by the state. Télé-Liban had a variety of non-written policies about how to, quote-unquote, preserve confessional harmony. One of those was that in all drama series, for instance, you cannot have characters whose names are typically Muslim or typically Christian. So you'll have lots of names like Imad and Hisham and Marwan, but you don't have Muhammad and Antoun or Maroun. That was kind of an interesting unwritten policy that people stuck to. And if you look at, luckily, I'm going to talk about why, because of confessionalism, Télé-Liban went into decline. What they do now to survive, they play their old archives from the 50s and the 60s and 70s. So it's great for someone like me to record these and actually be able to get access to them. And what you see really is, in some cases, an avoidance to deal with confessional politics. In other cases, very smart, indirect ways. Series, old series like Abu Milhem, for any of you who remember it. This portrayed very traditional village-based ways of conflict resolution. It's a very, very interesting series that dealt with the difficulties. Okay, how do we deal with, you know, especially in that series, it was Druze-Maronite relations, although they were never spelled out as such. There were very interesting stories going on. In wartime, there was an explosion of the media sector. Every single warlord, businessman, somebody with any kind of political or economic clout opened their own TV station. By the mid-1990s, the Lebanese spectrum was completely overcrowded. The International Telecommunications Union was filing complaint after complaint. Nothing was changing. There were 50 terrestrial television stations and about 150 radio stations. And as you can imagine, there was everything from the extreme right wing to the extreme left wing, fundamentalism on all sides, communist stations, soft porn stations, you name it. Everything was there. After the war, there was a huge challenge. Okay, the Taif Agreement, the document for national understanding signed in Taif, called for reorganizing the media in, quote-unquote, a modern, non-confessional framework. Now, you know, the devil is in the interpretation, obviously. 1994, the Lebanese parliament passed the audiovisual media law. It was hailed as a very important milestone. It was the first of its kind in the Arab world. But again, the problem was implementation. In 1996, when the law was finally implemented, licenses were given according to confessional basis, largely speaking. And typically, the people who were very highly placed in the government, the late Rafiq Hariri got his station, Nabih Berri got his station, although there was no station when he applied for a license. I talked to people who worked in the ministry, and some of the files that they have are absolutely unbelievable. Some people got stations, got television licenses, based on a one-page memo. And according to the law, you have to file about 500 pages of documents, where you get your money from, what's your programming grid, all that stuff. So there were all kinds of playing in the licensing process, again, it's based on confessional politics. Now, since then, the system has been relatively stable with a few outbursts. And this is what I'm calling drive-by confessionalism. What do I mean by this? You watch LBC or Future Television. LBC was launched by the Lebanese forces, a Christian militia during the war. Future Television is owned by the family of Rafiq Hariri primarily. You watch them and you see there's usually, in general, there's some kind of balance. You know, there's nothing really inflammatory. And then something happens, be it an election or Danish cartoons or any event, any kind of perturbing event. And suddenly you have flashes of pretty ugly stuff. that you see, you know, very, very basic appeals to sectarian identification using a certain iconography, focusing on some pictures, some news footage. It's amazing. Sometimes you see the same event and you're literally watching two different events. Now, what are the mitigating factors that have decreased this, that have led to, in general, a sense of concern for, you know, interconfessional stability with these few episodes of again, what I call drive-by confessionalism? One of them is business interests. The argument that Lebanese television stations are only political instruments is incomplete. Business interests have figured in the calculations of most television executives. In the middle of the Civil War, in the 80s, LBC played special Ramadan programming. Why? You know, this is, after all, the Maronite station. Why would it do this? Where, for a variety of reasons, one of them is business. They know how many Christians there are in Lebanon. And television, yes, gets subsidized, all kinds of subsidies from politicians who pay to appear on one episode of this or that show, depending, you know, the going rate could be anywhere from, it used to be 10,000, now under 100,000 you cannot get on some of the shows. But more importantly, there were some very strong business calculations that still exist that disappear when there are big events. When Rafiq al-Hariri was assassinated just about a year ago, a future television forgot anything about business. It became an open-air platform for a political statement. There are also some interesting oddities. Interestingly, the oddities were not licensed by after the in 1996. The main example I have in mind here is New Television. A New Television was initially the platform of the Lebanese Communist Party. It got funding from the Soviet Union to get started. The Soviet Union was just on its way to disappear. It disappeared, and then they got desperate. We need to find, you know, somebody to bankroll us. And what they were looking for is, that many people in the station put it in those words to me, was a multi-billionaire with leftist tendencies. So I thought that was very interesting. They found Tahsin Khayat. He bought the station. He's a Hariri nemesis. Everybody knows that. And the station is, New TV is extremely interesting in the sense that it always goes against the grain. Its main political platform is anti-Hariri. Whatever he does, whatever his, you know, people do, they're against it. But New TV did something very interesting in the elections of 2005, which is it continued its anti-Hariri message. And because most other media, especially Future and LBC, the two dominant stations, were very pro-Hariri, New TV made some serious gains in the ratings. Okay, I talked to people at New TV, even people at Future TV and LBC, in addition to market researchers, agree on this, that New TV made some audience gains, which led some of the others to also recalculate, which is to say, yes, we have a political message, but we need to balance it with our ratings. And this is, again, the untold story of Lebanese media. So anyways, that's the 2005 elections. Media and in the so-called Cedar Revolution a year ago. People go, Rafiq Hariri is assassinated, the Lebanese descend on the streets, the very early demonstrations, you had all kinds of flags, yellow and green and white and red. Very quickly, the organizers decide we're just going to put up Lebanese flag, which is perhaps only a symbolic gesture, but it's a very important symbolic gesture. One of the things you see is that the Syria revolution was not really confessionally based. Yes, we can say that the Shias, a very large group, was not an active participant in, you know, it was, they organized their counter demonstrations. But nonetheless, you had kind of Sunni Druze, a Maronite coalition on one side. Within that coalition, there were all kinds of fractures. So if you look today at the Lebanese parliament, really the coalitions are not based on confessional politics, with a couple of exceptions. So that's something that's very important to remember. And the thing I'd like to conclude with is how the media dealt with last Sunday and last Monday. There were two major events. One of them on so-called Black Sunday was a demonstration at the Danish consulate. The Danish consulate lost a couple of windows. A bunch of people lost their livelihood in the neighborhood. But what was very interesting about this, and if you look at how Lebanese television stations covered it, is the following. LBC and Future Television focused predominantly on the fact that a lot of the demonstrators were Syrian and to a second degree Palestinian. Then when the news came to covering how the local communities reacted to it, LBC and Future were very similar in the sense of there were all kinds of meetings between clerics from all sides, civil society groups from all sides saying, no, this is not us. Nobody meant to throw stones at a church. Nobody meant to insult the prophet. All this kind of discourse was very, very strong. What's also very interesting is that the next day, as some of you know, there was an agreement that the press, nearly across the board, hailed as a coup, which was the signing of a memorandum of understanding between Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and Michel Aoun Tayyar. And people said it's a coup. Some columnists in the Gulf called it a second Ta'if. I wouldn't go that far. It's not very clear on what exactly they agreed upon, except generalities. But that was, again, I think, a very important signal. The fact that the media focused on it so much, that you have the most powerful Shia formation coming with the most powerful Maronite formation, in the parliament at least, probably on the ground, is very, very significant. So again, in general, you know, making a blanket statement about the media in Lebanon being completely confessional is a very incomplete statement, to say the least. There's all kind of movement going on in some opposite directions, primarily because if you talk to young people, and these are the people I do most of my research with, the 15 to 25, 15 to 30 age group. On one hand, in a small group of them has very strong confessional identification, much stronger than it was a few years ago. On the other hand, there's a sense that the majority is fed up with all of this. That's why, for instance, UTV is gaining viewership among young Maronites. That's one example, perhaps because they cover down favorably. But we see that there is movement, and what really needs to be done is have some kind of a sane policy to deal with this, as opposed to, you know, again, all the dealings between whoever is doing media policy occurs at the confessional basis, so that if LBC does something wrong, you have to go through the Maronite political bosses before you can, you know, tell them anything. Same thing with the other stations. Now, a couple of interesting things that I'll conclude with is that the media stations themselves have a group that meets very regularly, that they developed a long time ago, but that really became active after MTV was shut down in 2002 for reasons I will not get into now. And what they do, they try to deal, they do what one person who, you know, is on really interested in what's going on in Washington calls it preemptive media policy, which is to say we're going to do whatever it takes for nobody from the Ministry of Information to ever even think of messing with us. Right? That's very interesting because they meet and they talk about what to do or what not to do. But again, when there are, you know, political flashpoints, you see very confessional-based reporting on the stations. I hope this made sense. This is part of an ongoing project, and I'd love to talk about it more with any of you later. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm not sure this is a situation of the you left the best to the last, or well, okay.
Do you mind, gentlemen?
Not at all.
Marwan, I need a briefing about that soft porn station that I missed in Lebanon. I mean, he took some digs at the media. I might as well do the same. I've never been comfortable discussing Lebanese politics. I've always had, I think, a healthy jaundiced view of Lebanese political culture. And so I will say a few words about Lebanon and probably try to focus on some conflicting trends in the Arab world when it comes to confessional or sectarian or ethnic identities in the wider Middle East. But to answer the question posed by this panel, can Lebanon escape its sectarian, what was the title again?
Confessional.
Confessional destiny or fate or future. Listening to Hassan and Marwan, obviously, it seems, unfortunately, for a secularist like me, that confessionalism or sectarianism or Taifiya in Lebanon is part of our DNA. I don't know if one should use biology or in discussing political science or history. I've always felt that sectarianism or confessionalism or Taifiya has been the cancer on the Lebanese body politics, to use a phrase by John Dean describing the Nixon presidency. When the cancer is in remission, the body politics works relatively well. When the cancer returns, as it does periodically, it flares into civil strife and civil war. When you add to the fact that, and we've seen that in 1958, and we've seen it obviously, you know, between 1975 and 1990. Again, to use that medical analogy further, the regional, let's say, polluted environment has also contributed to the illness of the patient, of the Lebanese patient, as we've seen in the intervention of the Syrians and the Israelis and Lebanon's internal affair in the last 25 years. Now, you always hear Lebanese complain about the outside world. In fact, many of us in Lebanon went through a collective denial. The war was other people's war on Lebanese soil. Now, anybody who has any notion about civil wars everywhere, be it the Spanish Civil War, and by the way, the American Civil War is the only exception to this. Every civil war usually invites the neighbors to participate in the deadly game. Those of you, if you remember your European history, between 1936 and 1939, on Spanish soil, the whole European continent fought each other. This was a prelude to the Second World War. In fact, 4,500 Americans here went and played a role in that war under the banner of the Lincoln Brigade, if you remember. This is one of the... because of the Civil War in Lebanon, by the way, I became an expert on civil wars in Europe and in the United States. So, and yet, if you look at the Lebanese phenomena in the last 25 years, practically every regional and international power that played a role in Lebanon was invited and applauded by a certain Lebanese group. That includes the Israelis, the Syrians, the Iranians, and the Americans, and the assorted international multilateral force that intervened in the early 80s in Lebanon. And yet, we Lebanese are correct when we say we've had the most democratic, at times most liberal society and politics in the Arab world in the 20th century. We've had democratic institutions, we've had democratic practices, but we've never had a full-fledged democracy, and partly because of the sectarian and confessional makeup of the system. I mean, Hassan is very correct. The confessional makeup, the confessional or sectarian or ethnic identity, if you go beyond Lebanon, because we don't have too many ethnicities in Lebanon, is part of the, is a reality. It's a social, cultural, religious reality. Today, I hear many American observers of Iraq, for instance, lamenting the fact that, or blaming the United States for creating sectarianism in Iraq. Where were you, people? I mean, there is this silly notion in Washington, even among serious social scientists and historians, that the Ba'ath in Iraq or the Ba'ath in Syria formed and established secular governments. It's a big lie. Ba'athism in Syria degenerated into sectarianism. There was a veneer of Sunni Islam, if you will, to the Ba'ath party. But beneath that, we had, as is the case with the Assad dynasty, father and son, is Alawi rule, essentially. When Assad was around, we used to talk about Syria and say, there is an Alawi core to the regime with the Sunni Arab veneer. Now it's not even an Alawi core. It's a dynasty. It's a family. In Iraq, secular Ba'ath, so to speak, degenerated into Sunni rule. The Takritis, essentially, were ruling Iraq. And it degenerated, that rule degenerated into or expressed itself at one time in a genocidal war, through the Anfal campaign that was waged against the Kurds in the north in the late 1980s. It degenerated into a sectarian war against the majority Shia in the south. So sectarianism is a fact of life. Now, obviously, we all have to agree that the American invasion of Iraq deepened the sense of confessional, sectarian, ethnic identification on the part of various Iraqi communities. It did not create that. The Iraqi Shia community, like the Shia community in Lebanon, numerical majorities, if you want to call them that way, were marginalized for 80 years, which is the life of the modern state, Iraqi state, and they were marginalized in Lebanon for most of Lebanon's independent history, in modern history. The Shia of Lebanon came into consciousness when Imam al-Sadr came into being as a charismatic leader who mobilized the Shia community and gave them a sense of purpose. Now that leadership switched from Amal, which was established by the Imam, to Hezbollah. You know what they say about us Arabs? You can get us out of the desert, but you cannot get the desert out of us. It's a joke. The first time I've seen it, camel was in, I was 20. All right. Can Lebanon be a model? No, it cannot be a model. The Lebanese communities are a collection of communities and minorities. And the only positive thing about this amalgam of communities living with each other, interacting in certain domains and not interacting in other domains, is the fact that we've had a system that did not degenerate into a strong central authoritarian regime, as we have seen in neighboring Damascus, Baghdad, Cairo, and other Arab capitals. So at times we did celebrate the weakness of the Lebanese state, because it allowed a vibrant society, a liberal society on the whole, to exercise its role. It allowed a civil society to flourish in many ways within these communities and sometimes across the communities, the boundaries of the communities. But a too weak state, obviously, gives too much influence to various communities and through the various communities to international regional powers. So inherently the regime was weak. Inherently the regime in Lebanon, political culture in Lebanon, political system of Lebanon, was also unfair. In the 1860s, I was just joking with Ahmad before we got here, the ruling Druze elite did not realize the emerging power, economic power, because also Marwan is correct, we talk about sectarian identifications and interests, but we don't talk sometimes about the social and economic factors. In the 1860s, the Druze ruling community did not realize or did not want to admit the rise in terms of influence, demography, economic power of the Maronites. The Maronites who worked for the Druze Iqta'i leaders descended from the north to the mountain and challenged the Druze community and the Druze leadership. And when the Druze did not recognize that, that was the spark that led to the sectarian bloodletting of the 1860s. A century later, the ruling Maronite elite did not recognize or were in a state of denial when they were watching the majority, the changing demographics of the country and the emergence of the Shia community and other communities in terms of economic power, in terms of demography. And that was one of the reasons, obviously, as Hassan and Marwan mentioned, I mean, there were other regional factors, economic factors or whatever, that also led the country into the bloodletting that continued on and off from 1975 to 1990. Now, I agree with Hassan. Maybe we can improve the system, maybe we can reform the system, but we have to do that through the electoral reform and social and economic development. But the Lebanese formula is not a model for the Iraqis, for instance. And here, let me backtrack a little bit and talk about two conflicting trends in the Arab world and talk about a world that has disappeared. But just to give you an idea about a different era in which confessions and sex interacted with each other in a more or less humane way. When you look at the Arab world today, now we all agree that most Arab states, like most African states, like most states in the world, have artificial boundaries. And in the case of the Arab world, they have boundaries or lines that were drawn in the sands by the colonial masters. With the exception of Egypt, Morocco, Yemen, and others, the issue of identity in the Arab world did not develop fully even until this moment. You will never, I challenge you, you will never find an Egyptian who has an identity crisis. The Egyptians who invented time, who invented bureaucracy, who had the Nile flowing since time immemorial, who had the pyramids standing there since time immemorial, are comfortable in their Egyptianness. And the only culture that changed them radically somewhat was the Arab invasion, if you want to call it that way, or the Arab conquest, al-Fath al-Arabi. They became Muslims, but they retained that sense of unique, peculiar Egyptian identity. And every subsequent culture that came was Egyptianized, not the other way around. That's why the Egyptians have this joke about the rest of the Arabs, those who live in the Arab East, they call them a bunch of tribes with flags. And there is some truth in that. If you take the issue of identity is at the core of the Algerian problem. The Algerians are still struggling until this moment with the question of identity. Who the hell are we? Are we Arabs? Are we Berber? Are we Mediterranean? Are we Muslims? Are we Africans? Now, all of us are an amalgam of identities. But sometimes there is a hierarchy in these identities. In Iraq, we have a problem of identity too. I mean, notwithstanding the 8-year period of the Iraqi modern state. Now, obviously, the situation in Iraq is more complex than what you read in the American media. A bunch of Kurds live in the north, a bunch of Sunnis live in the center, a bunch of Shia live in the south. It's more complex than that. But that's also partly true. Now, what we have in the Arab world, notwithstanding the artificiality, I don't know if that's the correct word, of the state system or the state boundaries, is that the state, fortunately or unfortunately, have proven themselves to be very resilient. Notwithstanding the breakup of the artificial state of Yugoslavia or the artificial empire of the Soviet Union. So what we see now in the Arab world is these two divergent currents or paradigms, if you will. On the one hand, people believe in the current states, the borders of most of the state system in the Arab world. And as you've heard correctly, most Lebanese now, most, not all, believe that Lebanon should be their final homeland. Probably that same sentiment maybe that exists in Iraq and other places where you have these ethnic and confessional cleavages, as the social scientists would like to say. At the same time, you have a more pronounced sense of sectarian ethnic confessional identity, just as it is on the broader international level. You have the forces of globalization working in one way, and the forces of ethnic and regionalism and other forms of identities also competing with that. We have that in Lebanon, and we have that in Iraq. Now, the problem is how to work out a system in which a multicultural or multi-ethnic or multi-confessional society like the Lebanese one or the Iraqi one can work with each other. The Lebanese model cannot be the model, or the Lebanese case cannot be the model, because you have, as I said, a collection of groups without one dominant power. I mean, in Egypt, when you talk about the Copts as a significant Christian minority, 10, 11 million people out of 70 million people, then you talk about the majority Sunni population. That's it's radically different than Lebanon and the situation in Iraq. And that's why the Lebanese formula cannot be a model for the rest of the Arab world, and definitely cannot and should not be a model for Iraq. This would be a disaster. If anything, the Iraqis should learn from our system, from the failures and the flaws in the Lebanese body politics. At the same time, what we see in Iraq is, as I said, this kind of assertiveness on the part of each community, particularly the Shia, the largest community in Iraq, a community that was sidelined, marginalized, oppressed by a Sunni elite ruling in them in Baghdad, notwithstanding the veneer and the cover of Arab nationalism and secularism and all that nonsense. Now let me draw a comparison between this, as I referred to earlier, the bygone world of that existed in places like Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and the so-called liberal era, that is, the era between the two world wars, first war and the second war, and that emanated essentially from what Hassan said about the Turkish millet system in a way. And notwithstanding all the problems with the millet system, and obviously that insults our modern sensibilities as modern men and women, what existed in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, was a more tolerant political culture in those days. Any of you, those who know Arabic, if you watch Egyptian movies made in the 1930s and 1940s, you know what I'm talking about. In 1926, a man named Ali Abdelrazik wrote a book called Al-Islam wa Usul al-Hukm in Egypt. It was a revolutionary book. Talk about the separation of church and state, so to speak. He was not killed. He created an uproar. He was not killed. Compare that with the fate of Farag Fouda, who was shot and killed. Compare that with the intolerance that exists today in a place like Egypt, which used to be one of the most tolerant Arab societies. When an icon like Najib Mahfouz almost lost his life at the hand of one of those radical nuts who called themselves Islamists. There was political life in Iraq between the two world wars under the monarchy. There were political parties. There were more or less vibrant press. Communities did interact with each other. The same in Syria. In the early 1950s, Syria, a majority Sunni country, had a Christian prime minister. If you look at the formation of all the political parties, especially the leftist political parties, and coming from a leftist background myself, I know that history very well, you see an incredibly important role for the minorities, people who felt, in a way, a sense of communal and ethnic and religious identity, but they wanted to transcend it. And that's why if you look at the communist parties were established in Lebanon and Syria and Palestine and Egypt and in Iraq in the 1920s. What do you see? You see a role for the Christian Arabs, the Armenians, the Jews, the Kurds, and the Druze, and others, and with the usual assortment of Sunnis. The Syrian National Social Party, or whatever, I don't want to call it in English, was established by a Christian Lebanese, which called for the greater unity of Bilad al-Sham, Eastern Mediterranean. Even the Ba'ath Party, one of its co-founders, was named Michel Afla, a Christian Syrian. The tragedy of that Ba'ath Party, this is just an aside to give you an idea, but the wisdom of Saddam Hussein and his bunch. Michel Afla was driven out of Syria later on. There was a court ruling against him. He ended up in Iraq, obviously. And when he died, he was used, of course, by Saddam. And when he died, it was revealed that this poor soul had converted to Islam before he died. This was during the period when Saddam rediscovered Islam, when Saddam put the words Allahu Akbar on his flag. When Saddam in the 1980s hired an Egyptian journalist, unfortunately, even in my business, I mean, there are people like, I mean, you know, people who do our profession the kind of honor that Dr. Mengele did to the medical profession. And this fellow, Amir Iskandar, came up with a tree for Saddam Hussein, claiming that Saddam is a direct descendant from the Prophet Muhammad. And lo and behold, the great Iraqi press began to refer to Saddam Hussein as Hafid al-Rasul. the grandson of the prophet. Talk about secularism. Talk about secularism. I mean, this is heresy, to use a religious language. In that bygone era, too, I mean, if you look at the social interaction among these groups, just picture in your mind the Eastern Mediterranean map of the Eastern Mediterranean region. Start with Aleppo in the north, going all the way, Damascus, even including Baghdad, Beirut, all the way down to Alexandria and in Cairo. What do you see? An incredibly rich human mosaic, an incredibly rich human tapestry of groups, subgroups, sects, you name it. And the interesting thing was that this group would interact in certain domains. You go to Damascus and there is a Christian quarter, a Jewish quarter, an Armenian quarter, a Druze quarter, God knows what quarter. And yet, these groups would interact in certain domains, like the political or the economic domain. You would have a Sunni entering into economic partnership or business with a Jew or a Christian. At the end of the day, the Druze and the Christian and the Muslims or whatever, you know, would like to marry his son or his daughter to someone from the same community. There was a situation that one can describe as voluntary segregation in the social religious areas, so to speak. But there was a degree of civility in that interaction. People accepted each other. There were no mass graves in the liberal era in Iraq and in Egypt and in Syria. There were mass graves under the secularist rulers of the Ba'ath in Damascus and in Baghdad. The centralized authoritative state that emerged after the Second World War in these places. Maintained itself through the means of coercion on a massive scale that we would not see in that so-called liberal era. And that's why when we contrast the situation in Iraq today, or Syria, or Egypt for that matter, with what occurred or what happened, or what existed in that liberal era, we see the huge difference. We see the degree of political decadence, if you will, that we succumb to in most states in the Arab East. What's taking place now, and now let me just conclude by a few words about Lebanon and Iraq. What's happening in Iraq, obviously, is worrisome for all of us who would like to see the emergence of a more rational, humane, fair political system in Iraq out of that huge, incredible mess that we found Iraq today in. And while one has to take into consideration the fact that the Shia majority now in Iraq, barely a majority, but still an American majority, should have their place under the sun, one has to raise certain questions about what's taking place in Iraq through this Shia assertiveness, if you will. When confessions and communities live with each other, in an environment that has its share of tension, if you will, this may be manageable somehow. But when they are armed, then you have a serious problem. And that's why in Lebanon, one of the biggest problems today is what to do with Hezbollah's weapons, what to do with Hezbollah's military wing. Here you have, in Lebanon, a situation in which you have a large community, the most politically organized, militarily organized group, is acting as a state within a state. Hezbollah has its own political party, its own political military wing, its own media empire, its own cells all over the world, its own sources of independent source of income, its own so-called strategic relationship with regional powers like Syria and Iran. What to do with this phenomena in Lebanon is one of the biggest problems. And yet, while even someone like me who does not like the situation would have to say and have to admit that that the Shia community is not, under Hezbollah's leadership, if you will, is not going to voluntarily get rid of its weapons unless there is a radical transformation of the political system in Lebanon that would give the Shia their due, their rights, as the new majority of Lebanon. And this is a very touchy issue that no political group in Lebanon is willing to discuss openly and honestly, let alone to deal with it in a meaningful way in the foreseeable future. We have a similar situation in Iraq. The Shia assertiveness in Iraq is taking on certain disturbing forms. You go to the south of Iraq and you see the rule of the militias. You go to the south of Iraq and you see people insisting on living in a quote-unquote Muslim environment. You see the growing tendency among the Shia for a theocratic form of governments, more or less. I mean, the sophisticated among them, obviously, they don't say it, you know, explicitly. But that's a tendency that exists there. And it's playing on the fears and the xenophobia, if you will, now, of the former ruling Sunni elite in Iraq. And when you add to that crazy stew, the role of the so-called jihadists and the irresponsible action of neighboring governments from Damascus to Iran, you have a very combustible situation. Confessionalism, unfortunately, is a reality in the Arab world. Ethnic identification is getting more and more salient and more pronounced. And we have an Arab world that is ruled today by a collection of political elite that really wasted our resources, forced us to live in a situation where we, most Arabs in the Eastern Mediterranean, find ourselves always reacting to what our non-Arab neighbors are doing, be they the Israelis, the Iranians, and the Turks. Everywhere you look in the Arab world, there is very little good news, unfortunately, and that's that. I guess I would have to conclude with that one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all you gentlemen. I'd like to open it to some question and answer period, discussions, things like that. But please walk up to the mic if you can, so everybody can hear you, and also your question can be recorded. So, if possible, just direct your questions to a specific person, because let's try to mix it up a little bit.
Okay. Regarding Dr. Crady's mention that, my name is Courtney Raja, I'm a PhD student at American University. Dr. Crady mentioned that everyone unified in February under the Lebanese flag, but then in April, this spring when Syria withdrew, we saw, when I was in Lebanon, I saw everyone gathered under their separate flags, you know, Amal, Hezbollah, everyone had their own flags again. So my question is a two-part question is, what is the situation now about unity in Lebanon? Is there still a Lebanese unity? Is there an idea that they want to gather around a Lebanese flag? Are they unified on this? And second of all, what are the possibilities of developing a Lebanese identity when we have the same leaders like Samer Jaja and Michel Aoun and all of the same people are still leading the parties? What's the status of the new leadership? And I'm not sure who the most appropriate person to answer this is, but maybe...
Gentlemen? I'm sure they're all capable.
As I had mentioned, I think that political class is not reflective of an underlying reality. It does not mean that the underlying reality is one of Lebanese unity. It simply means that in this underlying reality, there is a negotiation between Lebaneseness and the various communitarian belonging. Young people in particular, I mentioned to you a poll, which is very important. That poll, which basically says that 50% consider themselves to be belonging to the community first, then to Lebanon, 25% to Lebanon first, then to the community. This, if you take the Lebanese population in its totality, if you divide it according to age, the results are more interesting. There is more variance, by that I mean there is more volatility among young people. young people tend to feel themselves either more Lebanese or more sectarian, meaning, in other words, that the field is open for a Lebanese leadership that can claim a certain national space as opposed to the sectarian space, but that leadership, you're right, is not there. So the challenge in what comes next, is anyone going to be able to try to claim that space, or are we going to dissipate it? In my mind, that space is bound to grow now that the Syrian attempt at blocking it away is no longer there. It is going to grow. So sooner or later, someone is going to realize that there is potential there. Some political leader will realize that there is potential there, and they'll try to exploit it.
Well, just very quickly, which is what I fully agree with you, which is why, if as far as scientific metaphors are concerned, I think chemistry is much better than biology. To understand what's going on in Lebanon, Courtney asked about the unity after the assassination of Rafiq al-Hariri. One of the very important things is that, yes, there were all kinds of processes of fusion of political agendas at the time that faltered as time went by. If you read the Lebanese newspapers this morning, if you read, for instance, An-Nahar and As-Safir, one of the things that you get a sense of is that the so-called March 14 coalition there are all kinds of stories about it falling apart. So it's very fluid process. That's, in a way, that's bad because it leads to instability, but that's very good because there's no hold on power by anybody, because identities are, you know, or let's say political agendas are up for negotiation, at least parts of them. There will always be a core that very few people will dare, as Hisham said, to negotiate on. And that's why there's no... I thought the past year was an ideal opportunity to revise the fundamental rules of Lebanese governance. The situation was so chaotic that that would have been a very propitious moment to say, look, the Shias need to have some kind of recognition of their demographic and political clout. It's not happening as it is. The National Pact could have been revised. I really believe in that. And if you talk to young people, as Hassan said, you feel that readiness because they are fed up. They are absolutely fed up. You know, if a young couple that's from two different groups, if they decide they want to get married, chances are they won't be fully accepted by any of their families. Chances are they're going to have to, you know, get married abroad or live abroad. I mean, youth is fed up with this to an extent that has been... I've been going back to Lebanon, you know, on long research trips for the past 4 years, and I see this developing. And this is a very important phenomenon, I think.
My name is Reza Abu Hassan. I'm a Johns Hopkins student. I have two questions, one concerning the media to Mr. Kraidi, and one concerning politics to Mr. Mnaimi. Concerning the media, I just got back from Lebanon myself, and my first question to you is actually unrelated to that, but you barely skimmed NBN, Nabih Berri's channel, and you didn't mention anything about Al Manar, and I was mm-hmm. wondering... why? My second question, my kind of a comment, and I'd like to see your reaction to that, was I noticed something very interesting, that the evening news broadcasts in three or four channels are different. I think the NBN one is at 7:10 in the evening. Mm-hmm. The NTV one is at 7:30. And then the Future and LBC both air at 8 o'clock. So what my family does when I'm there, they first turn on the NBN, then they go to NTV. Mm-hmm. And then they go to LBC. If somebody says that NBN pisses them off, they just turn it off. But sorry for my French. But that's the way. That's an interesting arrangement they have. I don't know if they agreed to that. If they agreed to that time slots. Concerning the politics, Mr. Mnaimi, I think you had three recommendations to move forward. One, you recommended. This creation of a recognition of a 19th sect or 7th sect, the civil community. Number two, you said support civil society. And number three, I think you recommended a bicameral parliament. If I'm wrong, correct me. With regards to the civil community, I think that there's a problem there. And the problem is this. On the one hand, you have individuals that face... established communities, the communities are the Druze and the Maronite and the Shia and the Sunni. And these communities offer them comfort, emotional, financial, spiritual. It's comfortable to be in a community in Lebanon. It's very comfortable. And, of course, if you threaten them, they offer you with emotional violence, maybe. So my question to you is, in this sort of unfair stand where you have the individual on the one hand and communities on the other, what would you recommend? How could you come up with a community of individuals, is that possible, in order to face the pressures and the incentives that the other communities face?
This is thank you very much. This is a very, very long question, obviously. So if you gentlemen can try to be as busy as we can.
I'll be very brief. NBN, which is owned by the family and associates of Nabih Berri, the Speaker of the Lebanese House of Council of Deputies, has played, I think, a very positive role in what's going on. They can afford to do very experimental television, as far as Lebanon or anywhere else is concerned, because nobody watches them. That's the problem, and that's the tragedy. If you watched NBN over the past week, you'll see that they had several talk shows where they brought a Maronite priest with a Sunni cleric once and with a Shia cleric another time, and have them say, okay, what's going on? And a kind of a very open two-hour debate. That's very important. But NBN, in its best days, doesn't register at 1%. You know, in terms of Pan-Arab in Lebanon, on its best days, it gets to 5 or 6% of the audience. That's answer number one. Al-Manar, unfortunately, because of State Department decision, we can't watch anymore. So I haven't seen it since I was in Lebanon in the summer. So I can't. I don't feel comfortable commenting on what they did. Although I read a lot of secondhand reports. The last thing about newscasts, the way it happens, unfortunately, is the leading stations claim prime time. That's why Future and LBC have late hour newscasts. The others try to put it before to get more people to watch them, right? Because people want to get their news earlier. It doesn't always work. I don't think there's any agreement on when to air anything. In fact, on Wednesday night, both LBC and Future aired at the same time special productions on Rafiq Hariri and his legacy, which I think was not very smart politically, but they still did it because they're also commercial entities that are competing.
The idea of another community, of a civil community, is not actually a new one. It has been floating in Lebanese political discourse, socio-political discourse, for a number of decades. The idea here is simply to give, I mean, I described to you a process in which we have a communitarian order that is ancestral in more ways than one. And we have a new paradigm of state, community, individual that is evolving towards our recognizable notions of what a modern state is, a state in which the relation is between individual and state as opposed to between community and state. The two are in negotiation, to say the least, in Lebanon. The problem is that the second paradigm, the individual state paradigm, is not allowed room to grow because you have to refer to the community at all times when it comes to marriage, when it comes to inheritance and other functions. The idea here is to enable people to opt out of civil affairs under the control of communities by having another set of regulations for them. Mm-hmm. It will solve the problem that actually Marwan was describing, and actually that is faced in every generation. A Druze young woman and a Christian young man would like to get married. They have to go to Cyprus, and then when they come back, they're in trouble because of inheritance, etc., etc. It's not simply a matter of intermarriage, because even intermarriage formulas for intermarriage can be found. It's a question of having the right to opt out from a community without opting out from a religion. This, the equation of community and religion, as you know, in Lebanon is not true. I mean, many people would tell you, I'm an atheist, but I'm Shi'i. Okay, or I'm a communist, but I'm still Maronite nationalist or whatever it is. I mean, community and religion are not the same, and simply to create that separation by allowing legislation that regulates it. Mind you, Christian communities in Lebanon have a standard code of communal legislation that then they modify.
as opposed to, because the, in the case of the Muslim communities, they have a fiqhi tradition that they built upon. In the case of the Christian, there was no such a normative rule, so it was enacted for them in the 50s. And this is the time when it was said, why not enact an extra one for a civil community? I think this issue is still a valid issue that needs to be discussed, because it's reflective of what many in Lebanon would like to see.
Can I just add something?
Yeah, absolutely.
The problem of channeling the frustration of the youth and other disgruntled group in Lebanon into meaningful political action is the lack of the radical reform that Hassan was talking about. I mean, if you want to have a relationship between the state and the citizen that does not go through necessarily the community as the mediator, if you will, and if you want to use the institutions of civil society to be the mediator between the citizen and the state, then you have to allow for that political and social reform, maybe that will allow the emergence of those forces within civil societies, the political parties, the syndicates, the clubs, whatever we recognize as part of civil society, to play the role of the mediator between the citizen and the state. We don't have that because the state in Lebanon still deals with us as citizens through our communities, whether we like it or not. And that's why we are still trapped in that communal prison, if you will. And short of that kind of a reform, this frustration cannot be expressed or channeled into meaningful political action. And that's why, on a broader sense in the Arab world, those who talk about the new media in the Arab world leading to new politics don't know how to answer these questions. I mean, you sit in your house in Riyadh or in Bahrain or Kuwait and watch a television program on Al Arabiya or Al Jazeera or LBC, and they talk about corruption, they talk about the need for real empowerment and this and that, and you get intoxicated, you get angry, you get frustrated, but then what? Then what? You cannot do practically anything. In societies where you don't even have basic freedoms, like freedom of expression, freedom to organize, freedom to mobilize, and to embark on real political action. And in part, that's still the problem of the Lebanon of today.
Dana Eyre from USIP. I want to congratulate the panel on, I think, what is the most subtle and nuanced discussion on identity dynamics and the link between identity dynamics and politics that I've heard in Washington in about the past 18 months at least. The challenge, unfortunately, in Washington is that the U.S. government sometimes has problems being subtle and nuanced. So I want to ask you, and Washington is currently engaged in, indeed, almost obsessed with the Middle East. What are the implications of your analysis for overall patterns of and the nature of American engagement in the Middle East?
Michelle? Why me?
Put you on the spot.
As someone who believes deeply in reform, in radical reform in the Arab world, I believe that there are some powerful voices within this administration who are serious about the issue of reform in the Arab world. But they are, like most of us, puzzled and bewildered at time because we cannot anticipate what's happening there. And look at the American project in Iraq. I mean, it is going in the opposite direction that the Bush administration and the neocons and others had contemplated before they allowed the tanks to roll over the Kuwaiti borders into Iraq. Whatever the early intentions of the administration, whether the war was because of we want to remake the Middle East or finish the job that we began in 1991 or to help the Israelis or to establish a friendly regime in Baghdad that could help us neutralize the Syrians and the Iranians and achieve a degree of independence in the oil domain from Saudi Arabia or whatever. What is happening today in Iraq essentially is going in the direction of probably a Shia theocracy of some sort, notwithstanding the constitution. We may see a protracted low intensity civil strife that could last for a long time. And as Lebanese, I can tell you, it could last for a long time. Okay.
and the world will live with it. And that's really, that's something that sometimes we surprise ourselves here in the West. If somebody told you in 1980 that Saddam is going to invade Iran and that the longest conventional war in the 20th century will ensue at that time, that will include bombing cities, use of chemical weapons, use of missiles against civilians, tanker wars, you name it, you would say, no, you're crazy. And yet the world lived with this horrendous war for 8 years. And the victims were average Iraqis and average Iranians. And it was great business for oil companies. It was great business for those who manufacture weapons. And all the Arab money went there. The American technology went there. The British weapons and French, you name it. The world can live with it. And the world can live with a protracted, low-intensity civil strife in Iraq. Believe me. It is a scary notion, but it could happen. So I think the United States, when it comes to Iraq, should lower the ceiling of the expectations. Bush should not equate Germany and Japan after the Second War with Iraq today. Bush does that because he has no sense of history. In Germany and Japan, we had a completely different situation. You had homogeneous societies. You had highly developed societies, industrial base. The neighborhood wanted the Americans to succeed in Germany and Japan. And the Germans and the Japanese and the Americans had one common enemy after the Second World War, named the Soviet Union. None of this exists in Iraq today. Get out of there as fast as possible without leaving behind a messier situation. It's a big challenge. Lower the ceiling. I will be happy with Iraq today, in which no government agency could knock on somebody's door at 3 o'clock in the morning, snatch them from their homes, practice torture on them, basic representation for basic basic human rights, for basic groups, basic respect for basic human rights. But Iraq ain't gonna happen, ain't gonna become Sweden in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. And that kind of debate we are not having in Washington. And as long as we're stuck in Iraq this way, and we're going to pay dearly, and everything in the rest of the region, from the Iranian nuclear program to reform to everything else, will be wasted. And that kind of debate we're not having today in Washington. On the other hand, those who want the United States to leave precipitously and tomorrow don't know what they're asking for, because they are asking for war, for strife. And who will win if the Americans leave today and I oppose the war, in English and in Arabic, by the way? Who will win? The Zarqawis will win. The mullahs in Tehran will win. All those crazy, wide-eyed, radical Islamists who have dreams about the millennium will win. And all of us, and I include myself here as a secularist, will not even dare go back to that region. We are stuck in Iraq. We're not having the real kind of debate that we should have about Iraq and our options in Iraq. And there is cynicism around the Arab world. The Americans created this mess. The Americans should settle it. There's partly, there's a great deal of truth in that, too. But the Arabs, as always, the Arab rulers, that is, somebody else has to solve the problem for them. And they stoke the fires in the meantime. Look at the irresponsible behavior of all the neighbors of Iraq. All of them. So we're stuck.
Actually, I just want to add a footnote. I do not disagree at all with Hisham about the fact that the identities that are today highlighted have historical rootings. I'm talking about in the case of Iraq, Sunni, Shi'i, Kurdish. However, I would argue that there is a self-fulfilling assessment of these identities and an enhancement of these identities. And this is where the Lebanese situation, while Lebanon is not a model for Iraq, but the Lebanese situation can be used as a lesson, because identities at all times are multiple and at all times are negotiated. There's no such thing as an organic identity. Actually, Marwan mentioned the socioeconomic dimension that back in the 60s and 70s, everyone thought are primordial and everything else is the coating. Okay, then in the 80s we decided, no, that is basically an add-on. The real organic identity is the sectarian religious identity. All of these are negotiated, but the fact of the matter, any intervention, this is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Now I'm using physics in addition to chemistry and biology. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is whenever you try to test something, you affect it. Whenever you try to interfere in something, you affect it. And this is a major risk in the case of Iraq. I think where Lebanon can be an example, indeed, the March 14th coalition was one of a tactical nature and one of convenience at many levels. But who cares? It was a coalition nonetheless, and it creates its own dynamics. Yes, indeed, the parliament in Lebanon today, for the first time for that matter in a long, long time, the fracture lines in the parliament are not purely sectarian, because actually under Syria they insisted on having them be sectarian. They're not purely sectarian, but the components of these blocs are still sectarian. So what we're witnessing is subtle changes here and there, and in a certain sense it's the multiplicity of identities and the impermanence of identities that we can learn from the Lebanese situation with regard to Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East.
Hi, Julia Sheer. I'm at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And my question is addressed to whoever wants to answer it. You all seem to agree that there are no realistic prospects in Lebanon for a secular, non-confessional system at this point, and that there are bigger spaces for the representation of people who don't find themselves represented within the system, but there are still no viable political avenues. And on the other hand, there is a sense in Lebanon that the current situation is becoming untenable on all levels, on the security level, on the economic level, and on the political level, recently with a governmental paralysis. I wanted to ask if you see any willingness amongst the current political leaders to renegotiate some of the rules of the game and to renegotiate Taif, and not just in terms of tactical alliance, but an actual fundamental reassessment of Taif. Thank you.
Actually, let me disagree on your premise. I do not think that there is no room for actually to pushing the current system towards a more non-communitarian representation. I think actually this is the opportunity. I'm not sure who's going to do it, and I hope that whoever does it, I mean, it can be a very tactical move on the part of existing leadership, because as I was mentioning, I think that there is quite a bit of political potential to be exploited that is non-communitarian. It is not being exploited. Now, is it going to be exploited by some, in a Machiavellian way, by some political leader who exists today? Walid Jumblatt comes to mind when one thinks of that, because, I mean, he can remove his feudal lord hat and put on his progressive hat and say, well, what I am is I'm representative of a youth. Okay, he's young, I don't know. But in any case, I mean, someone else can do, Walid Jumblatt or someone else can do that. Or alternatively, I mean, here at USIP not long ago, we had Shibli Malat in a very daring action saying, you know what, I'm going to run for president. And in a certain sense, his running for the presidency, which is, as you know, in Lebanon, in a parliamentary system, it is the presidency is a result of the agreement of the political class. Might seems very much so Quixotian, meaning what are you talking about? This can never happen. But nonetheless, it might create some sort of resonance at the level of those segments of the population that had been frustrated by an artificial vertical segregation. So I do not necessarily agree that the room is not there. The prospects are dim. I mean, we're talking about really slim possibilities, but the stakes are so high, even when it is so slim, it is still worthy of following and worthy of expecting.
Speaking of sectarian feudal hats and progressive hats, there's a nasty joke about Lebanese. Don't you dare repeat it, but I'll say it as a Lebanese. It's along the lines of, Lebanese can be extremely sophisticated, but not necessarily civilized. But the issue, I tend to agree with you, I have a very, unlike 6-7 months ago, I had a bleak a view of where we're going in Lebanon now. I really don't see any group or a political leader or leadership that is capable of embarking on the kind of mission that you're talking about, with the exception of Hezbollah, which has a strong, charismatic leadership that essentially knows what it wants and knows its size and its capabilities and has that kind of self, sense of security, if you will. That doesn't exist with other communities, or we don't have similar leaders on the other side to play that kind of a role. Michel Aoun is a cynical player. Jumblatt can be highly interesting at times and highly controversial at times and highly frustrating at times.
Mercurial, yeah.
But at the end, he represents barely 7-8% of the population, and you know how it is. Unless you're talking, and you don't have another Hariri. And Nabih Berri now is an appendage to Hezbollah. The Maronites are still essentially frustrated and looking for leadership, and they ended up with Michel Aoun. I mean, you know, what a choice. Our Lebanese version of Peron, without Evita.
Without Berri?
Yeah. I mean, it's cruel. And I'll tell you something, and I don't like to repeat it, and I hate to say it in front of a Lebanese audience. If the issue of Hezbollah's weapons is not resolved in a peaceful way that would preserve face for the Shia community and its leadership in a year or a year and a half or 2 years, I bet you every other Lebanese community will begin to arm itself in the name of self-preservation, in the name of protection. And then you will see cynical regional players renewing their mischief role in Lebanon. And don't count on the Lebanese collective wisdom of learning something from the past. I mean, we have not done what the South Africans have done after the end of the apartheid, when they had a commission for truth and reconciliation. We had our own mass graves. We had our own massacres. We had our own ugly manifestations, and we did not even dare to confront, that dark reality. Even more than 20 years after the end of the war.
Just very briefly, there's the Hezbollah weapons is a very important issue. I think the other very important issue is the presidential election. You know, who's going to be the next president? I think that's what everybody's obsessing on right now, although it's not being spoken out. I think where all these issues will be negotiated is the new electoral law. Whether that's going to happen or not, nobody knows. However, I would disagree with Hisham on one thing. I agree with him that Hezbollah seems to know what they want. But I really think what the verdict is still out on this Aoun-Hezbollah alliance. I think this is a very interesting phenomenon that, you know, the press commented on it the first day that it's a coup, and then kind of there's really no analysis of what's going on. There are some very interesting figures also, which is that in polling done by several, you know, Washington-based institutions and a couple of local market research, Aoun is polling very well with Shias, even before this, right? He's polling very well with Maronites. He's polling relatively well with Sunnis. And I don't understand, you know, I don't agree with the analysis that there's kind of a Sunni Maronite versus a Shia Maronite formation that are duking it out. But I think the presidential issue will have to be resolved. And I think, you know, one of the primary aims of Michel Aoun by allying himself with Hezbollah is the presidential. I don't believe it's the only one, but it's a primary one. I think, you know, whether it's true or not, they are perceived in Lebanon, as you probably know, of being less corrupt than the others, both these leaderships, right? Whether it's true or not, I don't know. So that's very important. The second thing is, I think, you know, the weapons will have to be, you know, resolved very quickly. And I think the only way to resolve it is to integrate Hezbollah one way or the other in the Lebanese army. It's not sure. There are mixed signals on this. How that's going to happen, I think that's going to be the biggie, which is how are you going to keep the weapons but relinquish them at the same time? That's the only solution. Force is not going to work, and they're not going to relinquish them just because others want to. So I think this integration process is going to be the really crucial aspect of what's going on.
Patricia Karam from USIP. I had actually two questions, and as I'm sitting here in line, some of them might have been partially answered, so bear with me. The first one is on Iraq, and I was wondering, I heard two of you, one before and one as I'm standing in the line, say that if anything, Lebanon should not be used as an example. If anything, Iraq should learn from Lebanon. But the fact is that Lebanon is being used as an example, and increasingly so. And I just want to throw that back out, and maybe Marwan would like, and maybe since you're the only person who hasn't taken a stab at it, what is the alternative? I mean, just to play devil's advocate, if Lebanon is not a model that Iraq can use, then what other models are there out there for Iraq?
Saudi Arabia.
And the second question is basically, Julia, I wanted to ask, well, can Lebanon escape confessional politics? Julia heard you say, I think that's what you were saying, that you heard you say no. I heard two of you say yes, maybe, and perhaps one of you say no.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm correct, but Hassan, you identified prospects that are slim. In your talk, I thought you were saying yes, perhaps, through something that relates to a civic national media approach. And I'm not sure what I heard you say, but I think I heard you say no. So I just wanted to see what your reactions to that were, what your reactions were.
You know, very briefly on the Iraq thing, I do think that applying the Lebanese model kind of, you know, without any mutation, without any transformation, would be disastrous. But as you said, what's the alternative? I think there are lessons to be learned from Lebanon, and I think the key issue would be to insert mechanisms in whichever structure of governance is being created in Iraq that would create checks and balances, not between the different communities, but within the different communities. I think that's the problem with Lebanon. The problem with Lebanon is that if you want to deal with the Maronites, you have a couple of people you have to go through. Okay, and they're typically, you know, one at one point and the other at some other point. Same with any of the communities. If you had kind of diffusion of power within each community, then the situation would be, I think, very different. Because you'll have overlapping relations within one community to the state and within one community to the citizens. In other words, you don't want the Kurds to say, if the president's going to be Kurdish, we're going to decide who the president is. I think that's the problem. Or if, you know, the prime minister is going to be Shia, only the Shias decide who the prime minister is. And it's not enough to put, you know, a vice prime minister who's Druze and an assistant vice deputy, whatever, who's Kurdish. I think what you need to do is diffuse power within the communities, create a structure where within the communities there are several sources of authority. My answer to the Lebanon thing is maybe. I can't say no. Because I see movement on the ground, again, dealing mostly with young people, you get a very different picture. So that's why I would call myself an informed optimist on this. But maybe means long run, not anytime soon.
Actually, I would go as far as saying, as I stated, I think it's going to happen. It's inevitable that it's going to happen, but how much pain are we going to endure up until it happens? Because of the two paradigms, the one that is based on community is ultimately going to becoming obsolete. It is already obsolete in terms of the objective long-term interests. However, it's not obsolete in terms of the historical experience. People tend to be conservative. If you promise them too much in the future, they tell you, no, I'd like to have what I have today, meaning show me first and then I'll switch. The fact of the matter, we are going to be faced increasingly, if we look at it in long term, with opportunities for jolts in the direction of it happening. The question is, are we going to take advantage of them, or are we going to languish waiting for the next opportunity to appear? I'm suggesting that today is such an opportunity after the frustration of the Syrian occupation. Today is such an opportunity, and are there anyone there to be able to grab it? My answer is it's not clear at all. Actually, it does not look like it. However, it is not dependent on that messianic leader. Indeed, actually, Aoun presented himself at one point as that messianic leader, up to the point where some people think that he's actually the Messiah, but that's besides the point. This is no joke, actually, they do. But what I'm referring to, I suggested that in addition to the political class, which is unreformable because it has its own interests. There is a civil society that is growing and that might end up being the force that balances the political class and pushes someone in the political class towards a pragmatic decision to take advantage of that growing space.
I was talking about the foreseeable future. I mean, you cannot talk about what happened 50 years from now. I mean, who knows? You know, in 1985, there was a Soviet Union. What is it now? Who knows? Especially in a situation like Lebanon, where you have not only the Lebanese players and actors who determine their future, but also other regional outside actors too. It is possible, but not likely in the immediate future that we would escape the curse to use mythology now, of sectarianism. In Iraq, look, if sectarian allocation of positions a la Lebanon, if it is not for a specific short period of time, through a transition that is clearly defined and articulated, and unless you really revisit the Constitution completely and deal with the issue of religion in a more forceful way, which is not going to happen, obviously, I wouldn't bet my money on it, you're going to have a tenuous situation. You're going to have as brittle a political structure in Iraq as you have in Lebanon. The political situation in Lebanon is very brittle. And notwithstanding the frustration of the youth and the yearnings for a different political... I mean, Lebanese always complain. I mean, you know, we are a nation of whiners. We always complain. We don't like the same the political class that we have, but we always vote for them because we are trapped. We're trapped in the system. And I see nothing but cynicism in the Aoun Nasrallah marriage of convenience. Nasrallah is infinitely smarter than this village idiot. And Aoun is driven only by his blind ambition to become a president. What you have here, I'm going to give you quote unquote a Christian cover for your weapons, so to speak. All right, it's a marriage of convenience. If Aoun disappears from the scene, his whole tayyar will disappear with him. If Nasrallah disappears from the scene for whatever reason, Hezbollah's structure will remain. It will be weaker, but it will remain. It's not as transient as the phenomena of Michel Aoun.
But it would lose its ideological content.
That's true. You probably have fractured Shia community that would fight each other the way they did before.
How much it would lose its ideological content.
And we've seen it also with the Maronite community, you know, that fought each other before. And let's not forget, by the way, which is very disturbing in Lebanon, the Shia-Sunni divide in Lebanon. Now we talk Christian, Shia, Muslim, but what you have today, really, is the Shia-Sunni divide.
Well, I would go further than that. There's a Sunni-Sunni divide between rural and urban.
That's true.
And what has happened in just in reaction to the cartoons is an example of that. It's the Sunni rurals who came to the city and ransacked that building. And we blame it on the Syrians because now it's convenient for us to blame everything on the Syrians. Like in the past, we used to blame everything on the Israelis.
That's what happened when the Fallahin goes to the city. Yeah. My God, look at Iraq. Yeah.
Please, go ahead.
Omar Ghazi, I'm a Fulbright scholar at American University. So we all acknowledge the existence of sects in Lebanon and the political implications of this. But my question is, do those sects have a political culture that is stable and that transcends events? Like we've seen the shift of the Christian Maronites. All the build-up before was very anti-Syrian, and suddenly they accommodated Aoun's new position of having a sort of alliance with Hezbollah. So is there any stable political culture for any sect, or it's really what the leader tells them, and that's it, they can shift so easily?
That's an excellent question, if I may take a stab at this, because one of the things I did in the summer is I was looking at the roles of the different political formations in the demonstrations and how they organized, and I would disagree with Hisham on the issue of Aoun's movement is equally likely to collapse if something happens to him as Hariri's future movement. The difference is one is getting millions and millions pumped into it continuously; the other is not. That's one thing. And so talking about there are no political parties in Lebanon. That is a fact. Hezbollah came the closest to it, but because of its very pure confessional makeup, cannot really make that claim. And they do have a structure that's it's a warring structure. In other words, it has a very clear objective, which is a kind of a military presence against Israel. I mean, that's really what defines Hezbollah, and not much else, I would argue. And I would argue that religion, the religious factor, is becoming less and less important. That's why you see Hezbollah leaders making public statements about the Danish cartoons. This is typically not the kind of stuff that they're interested in, that they comment on. But the reason they did this is to regain some of the kind of religious legitimacy that they think is important, because the religious aspect of the party is decreasing. And since its military aspect was on the ascendant, that's why the weapons crisis is so, I mean, it's existential to them. If they lose their weapons, there's a chance that everything will collapse. Because if they lose the weapons, why would Iran be interested in financing them if they're not a tactical asset on Israel's northern border? So they understand that, and I think that's why that will remain the crucial issue.
My name is Julie Malahi, and I'm a graduate student at American University. I'm interested in the media sector of Lebanon, and especially with the deaths of Samir Asir and Gibran Twaini. And I'm doing research on that, and I was wondering, is this going to have a chilled effect on the new generation who want to speak out, scared for their lives? I think that's an important part of Lebanese democracy. And also I want to, on the sectarian issues, where do the Lebanese Orthodox, as a minority, belong in which, if there's the confessionalism, like where do they fit in?
Well, you know, both Samir and Gibran had the misfortune or the fortune of being the two really outspoken, I would venture to say the closest that Lebanon has had to a public intellectual, at least in the case of Samir Asir. And they're also symbols. In many ways, they are symbols of a variety of things. Most importantly, Samir's parents are Palestinian and Syrian. Gibran comes from a mixed marriage as well. His mother is Druze. And so to some extent, yeah, this is very important. One of the very interesting things that I discovered when I went to Lebanon in the summer, talking to journalists and going to their offices, people who were on the opposite ends of the Cedar Revolution, that's before Gibran's killing, obviously, but that's after Samir's killing, had Samir's posters in their offices. Some of them in institutions that were very clearly hostile to what went on. Gibran is different. Gibran is somewhat more controversial. There's kind of a religious aspect to his personality that Samir didn't have. But the journalists that I spoke to seemed to be more infuriated than scared by what went on. Some of them have toned down their language. That's quite obvious for those of us who read the Lebanese press every day. But I think there's anger. And now they're waiting. It's been a while. I mean, the span since Gibran's assassination has been longer. We're coming on 2 months now. It's much longer than what happened in the past. Typically, it used to be 5 to 6 weeks. So I think people are really waiting who's going to get killed next or if it's going to stop. But that's all conjecture, obviously. But
with regard to the question on the Greek Orthodox community, actually, your question underlines the importance of not looking at communities in a monolithic way, as if they are consistent components, and Lebanon is the sum of X number of communities. Because actually, we mentioned just before that, for example, within the Sunni community, one has to look at the urban-rural division, which is intense, and then at the regional divisions. The Sunni community of Tripoli is different from the Sunni community of Beirut, which is actually Saida. Hariri merged the one with Saida and Beirut, I mean, in terms of elite, but still, not at the level of the political class, mind you. I'm mentioning this just in order to underline that when it comes to objective socioeconomic interest, the Greek Orthodox community, which is represented in the margins of Lebanon, meaning in the north, in Beirut, and in the south, has had in those three regions alliances that are of a pragmatic nature with the political families of mostly of the Sunnis in the case of the urban, but in the case of the claim. Notice that the dominance of the Maronite community among the Christians is such that Maronite leaders tend to speak on behalf of the Christians as a group, as a totality, not on behalf of the Maronite community on its own. And actually, the six communities, the six, seven main communities in Lebanon, the seventh being actually the Armenians, but it's actually almost outside of the political spectrum when it comes to the negotiations. The six communities, the Druze community, which is the smallest, has had traditionally a political leadership that was able to overrepresent it on the political scene. The Sunni and the Shia are, and the Maronite are the three big ones. The Greek Orthodox and the Greek Catholic are the ones that, because they do not have a hinterland and they do not have a traditional leadership, have been basically claimed by the Maronite political leadership that speaks on behalf of the Christians.
Just quickly on Samir and Gibran. When the history of this period is written, people will give Samir and Gibran a very special place as the two most important Lebanese public figures who led the charge against the culture of fear and intimidation that the Syrians and their friends in Lebanon created in the last 15, 20 years or 30 years. Samir Qasir actually is the closest thing we had in Lebanon to what Antonio Gramsci used to refer to as the organic intellectual. Mm-hmm. And he was brilliant, smart, fearless.
And funny
and witty. I mean, he's a colleague of mine, he's a friend of mine. Actually, he's the one who brought me to a Nahar. Gibran was somewhat different, but Gibran also evolved from his religious background that Marwan referred to. But he was also equally fearless. And in the end, he was perceived and he acted as a Lebanese patriot in many ways. And that's why they are missed. And there is an incredible void, especially when it comes to Samir. I mean, in terms of intellectual commentary about the situation in Lebanon and in the Arab world, we lost a tremendously important voice, an Arab voice, not only a Lebanese voice. And in addition to that void, fear is returning, and Lebanese journalists, at least some of them, are practicing self-censorship. And without going into details, I get into, you know, heated discussions sometimes with my editors about this issue. And I'm more conscious than ever, at least since the assassination of Hariri and the departure of the Syrian troops, that I have to think all the time that I'm living in Washington, I can write certain things and I can think certain things, and I think, or I would assume, that certain things can be published. But my colleagues are in Beirut, and I could contribute indirectly to a tragic occurrence. I have to think about the paper, I have to think about the institution, I have to think about the colleagues, but obviously the dominant feeling that I have is one of rage and not fear. But it's a big problem. One word in passing about the Greek Orthodox community. They gave all the theoreticians and the intellectuals for all sorts of political groupings, mm-hmm. and ideologies in the Arab world. And this is a community that is very comfortable in its own Arab and Christian identity. Hassan is correct that sometimes the Maronites hijack the role of the articulators of Christian concerns in Lebanon. The Greek Orthodox Church played a very tolerant, open role during the civil strife, and they did not really produce the kind of sectarian leadership that other communities, Christian and non-Christian, produced in those dark days.
There was no Greek Orthodox militia. The closest to that you have is the Madari Orthodoxy, which is Orthodox civil defense.
You're going to close it.
I know we're out of time, so I'll be quick. I'm Judy Barcel with the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I want to draw the panel out on the question of the role of the Lebanese diaspora in reinforcing or diminishing the strength of the confessional system. We know a few things about the Lebanese diaspora. Number one, it's large and well-defined and has unusual ties back to Lebanon, with people even in many generations later returning back to, you know, live or reinvest in local businesses or repatriate capital, whatever. Number two, we know that much of that diaspora consists of the professional class, and these are people who perhaps would be more readily willing to identify their interests in class terms or other terms rather than confessional terms. Number three, however, we know that diasporas traditionally tend to reinforce the more extreme positions on issues within their home countries, that they often play an extremist kind of role because they don't have to live with the consequences of those positions back home. So my question to you is, what role do you see the Lebanese diaspora playing in either reinforcing the confessional system from abroad or as they return back and go back and forth, or in providing the support or the impetus for some of these forces that Hassan and Marwan have identified that give hope for the longer-term demise of the system?
Actually, very quickly, we live a middle-class life in Lebanon by proxy because of the diaspora that we have, because of the immigrants. Lebanon, as a society, has to include, when we think of Lebanon as a society, we have by necessity to include the immigrants, the emigrants from Lebanon, because their role in continuing the economic cycle and the socio-demographic cycle is continuous. In terms of your concern about conservative radicalization that can happen, actually what we see is that the first generation or those who emigrate tend to be far more extremist in their visions, but they get moderated in the countries where they are. For example, look at the Lebanese in the U.S. Those new immigrants from Lebanon in the U.S. tend to identify with their community and actually more often than not have extreme views, for example, be Lebanese forces or be whatever it is. But as time passes, what you have is a moderation of that, and what you have is not only a common Lebanese feeling, but in the case of the Lebanese-American community, an Arab feeling as well. Most of the Arab American activists in this country are Lebanese. They're not Palestinian or Jordanian or Yemeni or anything. And actually, as there is, and the same actually can be to some extent used in the case of Brazil, where it seems originally when they were thought of as being Turks, then Syrians, then Lebanese, but when they reach the very highest echelons of the socioeconomic reality in Brazil, they decided that they are Phoenicians. So, I mean, they try to distance themselves a little bit, but nonetheless, it remains that I think that the diaspora has had a moderating rather than a radicalizing effect on Lebanon, and I think we need them imperatively in all sorts of ways. Any future formula for Lebanon to succeed has to include them.
I'm not sure we can speak of a Lebanese diaspora overall, because if you look at the Lebanese diaspora in the Americas, for instance, in the U.S., to a lesser extent in Canada, but especially Mexico and Brazil, I know the case of Mexico very well because I go there very often. It's very different from the Lebanese in Europe. For a variety of reasons.
Or
one
in
of them.
Africa,
well, I'm getting there. Yeah, I mean, you know, the African Australian community, especially the Lebanese in Africa, they never feel that they're African, right? They're there to make money. Typically, when they get to a certain age, they're spending more time in Lebanon than in Africa. So that's one. In the Americas, they tend to be much more integrated. And I think Hassan described the situation quite well, with a couple of exceptions. There are a couple of groups that tend to be on the extremist fringes. I know that in Mexico, for instance. But they haven't played the kind of role that the Irish or the Indian diaspora played. We don't see any serious money being funneled back to Lebanon, perhaps with the exception of Hezbollah, that does quite a bit of fundraising in South America.
Exactly. And also in North America. In this country, too.
But not
there's more money in South America and more lax laws.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So there is that. The Lebanese in Europe tend to be not as integrated as, you know, and they've been back and worked and moved around. So in many ways, it's a variety of subgroups within that large group. But I think overall, again, with the exception of Hezbollah, we don't see the kind of money funneling extremist causes in the mother country?
Well, I mean, these wonderful, open, articulate panelists here are not necessarily representative of the Lebanese diaspora, not even here in this country. And during the war, various communities did funnel money and support to their own communities. And definitely the case of Hezbollah today, where you have a greater reliance on the expatriate communities in Africa and in Latin America and in North America too. And that's one of the reasons why Hezbollah would like to maintain the portfolio of the foreign ministry for a variety of reasons. That's one of them. And the way they organize their cells overseas tells you something about how they collect money too. Extremely brilliant in that regard. So you find the moderate and the rational voices among the Lebanese expatriate community, especially in open societies and democratic societies. But in Europe, in most of Europe, and even in this country during the Civil War, you found also the other extreme, people stressing their communal identities and their own version and their own vision of Lebanon, which is not necessarily as inclusive as we would like to admit. The immigrants who, or the expatriates who leave and go and work in the Gulf or in Africa are transient. They cannot be accepted in those societies, and they know that they're there only to make money. In North America and Latin America and Australia and Canada, they can assimilate, and so the second, third generation are completely different than those who left the country during the war or immediately after the war. They are, in many ways, a microcosm of what exists in Lebanon. I mean, you have little Bintish Bail in Detroit, and Hezbollah recruits and Amal recruits there, and other places. It's less pronounced because these communities don't live in compact in their own little ghettos. But you find both tendencies, definitely.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to the panelists for being so open, so informative. It was really a very nice panel. I appreciate all your efforts. Thank you very much for being with us today, and hopefully we'll get together again on another Lebanon event. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.